for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. As head of the FDIC, Sheila Bair served an eventful five-year term. She was on the front lines of battling the financial crisis and subprime mortgage debacle. And she fought to put teeth in the biggest overhaul of U.S. financial regulations in more than half a century. Sheila Bair is in the studio to talk about overseeing the banking industry and protecting consumers. She is now senior advisor to the Pew Charitable Trusts. We will take your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Sheila Bair, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you take us back to the first time you became really concerned about those subprime mortgages?
Right. Well, I guess actually I have a long history with this issue, going back to 2001 and 2002 when I was at the Treasury Department. And then this was a very small segment of mortgage lending. And there were efforts on the Hill to pass a anti-predatory lending law that didn't go anywhere. And then the Federal Reserve Board also had authority to set lending standards to try to nip this in the bud, and they did not choose to use that authority. So I had worked with Ned Gramlich, the late Ned Gramlich at the Fed, to develop a set of best practices to try to get the industry at least to voluntarily agree to something that would address these steep payment resets, abusive prepayment penalties, negative amortization, all the things that we started seeing flourish really later on. So then, though, it was perimeter players doing it. It was viewed as a consumer issue, not as a systemic issue. And then I went into academia for 4 years, and I came back in 2006 at the FDIC, and the FDIC staff were already monitoring this and were very concerned about the degeneration of lending standards, not so much for what banks were doing on their balance sheet, but the loans that were being originated for securitization trusts, for private label, what we call private label or Wall Street securitization. So they were on it very early on. And I think the more we learned, the more the concerns grew. And so I would say by late 2006, we were very concerned. And then going into 2007, of course, our efforts ratcheted up to try to get stronger lending standards, proactive restructuring these mortgages before they started going bad.
You, Brooksley-born Elizabeth Warren, the three of you women, sounded the alarm.
Yeah.
To whom did you sound the alarm?
Well, I think initially it was with the other bank regulators. We pushed very hard for to tighten subprime lending standards.
Right.
Continued advocacy with the Fed to try to – they were the only ones that had the ability to write rules across the board for all bank and non-bank mortgage originators. And a lot of this was a product of uneven regulation where you had stronger standards for the banks, not much regulation at all for non-bank mortgage originators. And, of course, as the banks lost market share, they started lowering their standards, and we kind of had this downward cycle. So I would say pushing for stronger lending standards started in late 2006 – well into 2007, where we're able, after a process that was longer than I would have liked, in June of 2007, we were able to get out better, stronger standards for banks, at least, in the subprime area. But things were deteriorating so badly at that point, it really was problematic. Most of the damage had been done, so that was why simultaneously we started calling for restructuring these bad loans that had already been made.
Why do you think it was so difficult to get people who were in positions
right.
where they could have done something right. to heed your warnings?
Right. Well, I think there is just a sense of the arguments we were hearing back then was it wasn't going to be that big of a problem. And nobody really knew, but people were assuming, you know, maybe an 8% decline in home prices, maybe loss rates of 10 or 15%. I mean, things very much lower than that we wanted, what we ended up seeing. So there was a sense that it wasn't going to be that bad. The argument was we were going to tighten lending standards and constrict credit. We hear that a lot, as a rationale for doing bad lending. And so those are the arguments we were hearing. And I think they were made in good faith, but clearly in hindsight, they were ill-advised because people were getting loans they couldn't pay back. And that's not expanding credit availability. That's making abusive loans. And the wave of foreclosures that was building through all this bad lending had a terrible impact on home prices. And we continue to suffer from the ramifications of that.
Some have wondered whether, because the three of you mm-hmm. are women,
right,
whether the old boys network somehow right. played a role here.
Right. Well, I don't know. You never know whether gender has anything to do with it. And so I don't know. I think there were certainly men, too, like Ned Gramlich. He was very early on. He was the one, actually, who got me focused on subprime abuses in the early 2000s. Paul Sarbanes was another. So both genders were trying to sound the alarm here. But certainly in the regulatory community, it was the women were somewhat isolated, whether it was Brooksley with derivatives regulation or myself with the mortgage mess that we were in. So you just never know. But I just try to forge forward and make the best arguments I can make and build alliances where I can, because you just if it's there, it would never surface. And so I try not to dwell on it. Just keep pushing.
Fannie Mae's Home Affordable Modification right. Program has been such a disappointment yeah. to so many people. Why hasn't it worked?
Well, I think it was important to have appropriate expectations. We had always said that loan modifications were not going to be a silver bullet. It could have a significant impact on reducing foreclosure rates, but you were still going to have a lot of foreclosures. So I think maybe people got their expectations up, though I do think also, programs are all about operational execution. That's really important. And I think frequently in government, and I say this as someone who spent most of my life in government, that frequently you can have a good idea and a good proposal, and then where there's the problem is with the execution. And so I think perhaps with the best of intentions, the program became very complicated, which made it harder to comply with all the rules. And then, as we know now, servicers were simply not putting the money and resources and staff training into their servicing operations to do the legwork that was needed and still is needed to deal with all of these troubled loans. So I think it was a combination of factors. But I think there's still some good work being done. It has helped somewhat. Even though it's been disappointing, we're certainly better having it than not having it. But I do think some greater simplification and streamlining of the program could help, as well as obviously these banks need to put more staff and resources and money into their servicing operations.
Do you think they're going to?
Well, I was certainly pushing that at the FDIC before I left, and I think they're. I hope those efforts are continuing. Obviously, I'm not in the government anymore, so I'm not privy to those discussions. But we were pushing very hard for that. To more staff, better staff ratios, single points of contact. So a borrower has the same person from start to finish. That by itself will require more staff to be hired to have, people who can have that one-on-one relationship with the borrower, which is really necessary. And that's an important quality control as well to make sure that all the rules and legal requirements are met. Even if foreclosure ends up being the inevitable result, you need to make sure it was done appropriately and in compliance with all the rules. And by having a single person responsible for that process is a good quality control as well as something that can help consumers. So I believe we had agreement on that, on single point of contact. We also had indicated, and I still believe strongly, given the somewhat high error rates that we have seen in some sampling of loan mod denials, that all loan modification denials need to be reviewed to make sure they were appropriately done. And so those are things I hope the regulators, the bank regulators, are continuing to pursue.
Sheila Payer, she is senior advisor to the Pew Charitable Trust, former chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I look forward to hearing your calls, questions, comments, 800-433-8850. I realize that burning bridges is not something you tend to do.
No.
But I find myself wanting to ask you whether you believe President Obama could be doing more to help homeowners.
Well, I think he wants to do more to help homeowners. I think he said that publicly, and I have heard him say that in private meetings as well. And so I think he does want to do more. I think a couple of things, as I said, simplifying and streamlining these programs, I think it would be helpful. Having a more senior level involvement, government involvement, and better coordination, I think. You have a lot of different agencies involved in housing policy. You have Treasury, HUD, the banking regulators, the SEC, the FTC, the Justice Department, and of course, FHFA, the regulator of the GSEs that has probably the biggest chunk of this. There needs to be some coordination. I think there is confusion about what the policies are, and that's never good in terms of program execution.
Could he force Freddie and Fannie mm-hmm. to finance any loans because rates
right.
are so low?
Right. Well, I think that's a tough question. I think when loans become troubled, when the loan becomes delinquent, there's a lot of legal flexibility to restructure, to try to work with the borrower to rehabilitate the loan, to provide a mortgage that can be affordable if it's unaffordable currently to the borrower. In terms of loans that are performing, it's the legal obligations are tougher. Investors obviously complain if you have performing loans that you're reducing the interest rate. I'm not saying that's justified, but it does create more legal complications.
Sheila Bair, former chair of the FDIC. Short break, right back. And here is our first question from a listener for Sheila Bair, former chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It reads, in the past, the FDIC has taken over failed banks, continued to run them using employees and contractors. More recently, the FDIC actually took over very few failed banks, but instead made deals prior to the takeover with large banks and investors and transferred the failing institution to the new owners with favorable loss share mm-hmm. agreements. These deals were done in secret without any open bidding process. How come?
Okay. Well, I guess I would like to challenge the premise of that question first. Actually, most of our bank resolutions have been community banks, smaller banks, less than $10 billion, and the overwhelming majority of those have been sold to other community banks. So this has not been a situation where the smaller banks are being gobbled up by the larger banks. The vast majority of small banks have been bought by other community banks. Also, the process has worked very well for us. It has we do run an auction before the bank fails, but it is put on a secure website. Any bidder who is qualified, it has to be another insured bank, can go on and bid. It is subject to audit by our IG, by the GAO. And there is a robust bidding process, and the highest bidder is the one that acquires the institution. And the prices, the bid price is publicly disclosed, as well as the lower bids as well. We withhold the cover bid, the second best bid, for a year. But other than that, it's all public. So I think maybe that there's a misunderstanding of what our process is.
All right. And he goes on to say banks such as One West were given deals that guaranteed them no loss and actually rewarded them for foreclosing on customers due to the terms of the loan share agreements. Why did the FDIC continue to reward the bankers who were the cause of the financial crisis by giving them such sweetheart deals?
Well, I guess I would challenge the premise of that question as well. Actually, with One West, which had been IndyMac, we used the old process used during the SNL days, where the FDIC staff actually ran the institution for some period of time before it was auctioned off and sold to an acquirer. So, and I think the loss rates were higher with IndyMac, and I think one of the reasons was because it had to be put under government control for several months before it was sold. So which underscores
consumers lost their money.
So no consumers lost their money. The depositors were insured depositors were fully protected at IndyMac, and the loss share arrangement, again, it was the highest bid. We find that our loss share agreements save us money because we are asking bidders, first of all, the executives at IndyMac and the board are gone. They lost their jobs. So there was not lower level people stay, but the top management, they were gone. And that's typical with all of our resolutions, number one. Number two, we find that the loss share saves us money because if we're asking new parties to bid on a failed bank, which by definition probably has some very weak loans in its portfolio, they're worried about what the extent of those losses are going to be. And because of the uncertainty of what those losses will be, they will give you a very, very low bid unless we agree to provide some credit support for them purchasing those loans. We have the losses on those loans no matter what. When the bank fails, we own it. We pay off the insured. We always protect the insured depositors. And the way we recoup our losses is by selling assets. So we have that loss already. With loss share, by agreeing to take some of the future losses, some percentage, not the whole thing, we can actually increase the bid. And there's plenty of analysis that shows actually that we've saved ourselves about $40 billion by using loss share. A final point I do want to make, the loss share agreements affirmatively provide incentives for loan modifications, not for foreclosures. And that was a conscious decision we made. We pay on the loss share. If you modify a loan, for instance, if you take a 20 or 30% loss on the loan by reducing the borrower's payment by 20 or 30%, we will pay loss share on the difference at the time the modification is made. You do not have to go to foreclosure to get paid. We didn't want incentives to go to foreclosure, which is why we say very specifically we will pay on loss share when the loan is modified. So the incentives under loss share are to modify the loan, not to go to foreclosure.
Interesting that in dealing with these huge banks, which got so much money from the U.S. government, why is it that so many executives have not been held accountable?
Right. Well, I think that's a really good question. We have a very robust program of that I oversaw when I was there of holding executives to account for losses that they were responsible for
and
when banks have failed.
And how could they be held accountable?
We sue them. We sue them, and we go after personal assets, not just insurance proceeds. We go after personal assets, too. So we do think there should be accountability, and it should hit people in their pocketbook.
But didn't it shock you that so much money came from the federal government, from taxpayers, to bail out these big banks? Right. And then, for example, AIG and others got huge bonuses for their executives.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I could not. We were not. No, it's just full disclosure. We were not involved in AIG. I have no intimate familiarity with the facts there. But just reading the paper and reading some of the public analysis, I did not understand that. I did not understand that at all. I think that's one of the symptoms of the bailouts. If you bail out an institution, if you keep them open, then all those contracts are still enforced. They're enforceable. With the FDIC process, a bank goes into resolution, we can repudiate those contracts. So we will make a decision if it makes sense to keep an employee. To preserve the value of the bank, then we might, you know, again, lower level people, the top executives always go. We will make that decision based on what is in our interest. But there's no contractual obligation to keep anybody or pay anybody bonuses, and that was one of the reasons why we pushed very hard for resolution authority for all large financial organizations, not just insured banks. It partly to address this AIG problem, to give the government the ability to repudiate these contracts, where you end up paying people who got the institution into trouble.
You know, considering what has happened in this country with not only the loss of billions of dollars, right, but the loss of faith,
yes,
in financial institutions,
yes,
are you not shocked,
yeah,
that European,
yeah,
leaders are now considering doing the same thing we did?
Well, yes, and I'm very troubled by it. But I think they're somewhat in a box. They really don't have a resolution infrastructure in place. With Dodd-Frank, we put a infrastructure in place to resolve troubled banks.
Explain exactly what Dodd-Frank does.
Well, with Dodd-Frank, basically took the authority that the FDIC has always had to resolve failed banks and insured banks and impose losses on shareholders and creditors. It expanded that authority to include any large would be viewed as a systemic financial organization. So under this process, we can seize the institution with certain procedural safeguards. We can temporarily fund it and keep it operational as it is broken up and sold off. If there are any losses associated with that, and there will be, the shareholders and the debt holders take the losses. It's a bankruptcy-like process. It's really just an efficient government-run bankruptcy process. And so but it's important for financial institutions, given that the financial assets can flee an institution very quickly. If you don't have some short-term ability to fund it, to keep it operational as it's sold, you will lose franchise value very quickly. As we see the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, the losses there for creditors are going to be substantial because the place just fell apart when it went into a bankruptcy process. So we have that in place, and we have a centralized authority in the FDIC to carry it out. They're working on setting something like that up in Europe, but it's still a ways away. And of course, it's complicated by all the so many different countries who need to have a buy-in into this process. I think also they wouldn't be having the set aside resolution authority. You wouldn't even need to talk about that if I think the capital base of those European banks was stronger. We fought very hard for a leverage ratio, for higher capital requirements. With a leverage ratio, you have to keep capital against any asset, if it's sovereign debt, cash, whatever. But with the capital framework that most European banks are operating under now, these sovereign debt instruments, they didn't have to hold capital. They were basically viewed as zero risk. So that's another problem why the capital to absorb losses associated with this troubled sovereign debt is weaker than it should be.
So all of this comes down to how do people stay in their houses?
Right. Well, I think I think you should still, unfortunately, need to deal with the servicer, the name of the entity that is on your mortgage statement. There is much more intensive regulatory oversight now. They are required to have a single point of contact. You should demand that. Have the name of a person, the phone number, the email address, and deal with that person. If that person's going to be out on vacation or whatever, that person needs to designate who your contact will be. So I think those are obligations now that the major servicers have undertaken. Consumers should know that and know that they have the right to the name of a person to deal with on a continual basis. They should complain as well. They should complain to the bank regulators. They can go to the FDIC Complaint Center. We're not the primary regulator for any of these major servicers, but we can route the complaint to the appropriate regulator to hopefully get some relief.
Aren't you angry?
Oh yeah, I'm very angry. So much of this was avoidable, and I'm particularly
really avoidable.
Very avoidable.
If what?
If we'd had in the early 2000s, we had put in place mortgage lending standards that were applied across the board for bank and non-bank originators. That would have been helpful. If we had not started lowering bank capital requirements investment bank capital requirements, but increased those capital requirements, this could have been avoided. Once the loans started going bad, if early on servicers had been put more resources into their servicing operations, and the investors in these mortgage-backed securities had supported them in restructuring these loans, as opposed to some of them were fighting these restructurings, we could have it still would have been a problem. We could have gotten ahead of it much better.
But, you know, clearly you are angry. Mm-hmm. Clearly so much has gone wrong. Why did it all go wrong? Was it that people who should have known better simply refused to pay attention? Was it philosophical? What was it?
Well, I think it was, it's the taking away the punch bowl syndrome. Everybody was making money off of this. And for a time, even consumers, borrowers, getting these unaffordable mortgages, because home prices are going up, they could refinance out of them. They just kept refinancing. And so for a time there, everyone was making money off of this. And when everyone's making money off of it, it's very difficult for regulators to come in and say, we're going to stop the party. There was a lot of, the housing industry generally is a very potent political influence in Washington. And so I think that was the problem. I think it's symptomatic of a larger situation where government doesn't act proactively to get ahead of these problems. We wait until the crisis is there, and then we do something, and then it's always too late.
Sheila Bair, former director of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sheila, did you push for the Federal Housing Finance Agency lawsuits? Mm-hmm. Trying to recoup fraudulent mortgages from the major banks.
No, I had no role in that decision making. I think DeMarco is doing a great job, and as the conservator of Fannie and Freddie, it's his obligation to recover what he can for those conservatorships.
So
he's doing that.
Will accomplish that.
Well, I think there will be issues to be litigated, and frankly, I think there is probably a fault on both sides in terms of the former Fannie and Freddie management, perhaps knowing more than they want to acknowledge in terms of what was going on. That doesn't excuse mortgage originators and those putting the securitization deals together. For not adhering to reps and warranties, but I think there is probably, was fault on both sides. I think the broader problem is this litigation promises to drag on for many years, and I think could be a real drag on the housing market recovery. And so I think the sooner this can be settled, and banks need to understand there's significant liability there, and they will have to make significant settlements. On the other hand, investors need to understand that they had some culpability in here too, and not be unrealistic about what they should be recovering.
Can you talk about your relationship with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner?
Well, I think people, perhaps the media, some of the media have made that more than it is, and that just goes with the territory.
I'm not making it.
All right, no, you're not. It was not directed at you at all. I think we had philosophical disagreements. I think I like to think it was not personal. Well, I think bondholders, for instance, we thought, or counterparties, unsecured counterparties for these large institutions, the bailouts were really bailouts for them. We thought they should take some losses. We were asked early on, it was suggested to us, that we guarantee all bank and bank holding company debt. Now, we insured deposits. We don't insure bank and bank holding company debt. And so we pushed back on that very strongly. We had suggested at one point that maybe perhaps they should all take a 10%, or that they should only be guaranteed up to 90%. There was no agreement on that. And so what we ended up doing when things really got bad after Lehman, we did agree to guarantee new debt so that banks, when the markets froze up, they couldn't roll their debt. But we charged a very significant premium for it, and that the program ended up making a lot of money for the FDIC. So if I'd had my druthers, I wouldn't have done anything. But, you know, I think after Lehman, there was a strong case to be made that the liquidity situation was such that, at least for new debt, it needed to be there needed to be some support for banks to be able to continue funding with new debt issuances. So we did that. But I think, you know, unsecured creditors, I think when financial institutions fail, the stakeholders should be taking the losses. That's the way a non-financial, you know, commercial entity goes into bankruptcy. It's the same priority. The shareholders are most at risk.
What about that notion of too big to fail?
Well, I think, you know, I think there are some that just want to accept it as a fact of life, and there are others that it really rankles, and it really rankles me. I think, you know, I grew up in a conservative Republican household, and you stand on your own two feet. You don't take government assistance unless you absolutely have to.
Sheila Bair, former chair of the FDIC. When we come back, your comments, your questions, I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world, more at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
30 years after President Reagan broke the air traffic controllers' strike, an historian examines the consequences for air travel and American workers. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. It's your turn. We'll open the phones first to Karen in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Hi, Diane and Sheila Bair. I would like to know if there is any whistleblower bringing the attention of the short sale problem into clear view.
Mm-hmm.
The banking industry has done a terrible job of approving short sales for the homeowners.
Right.
They either have extremely slow processing or lack of processing. What happens then is that the homeowner actually goes completely into foreclosure, and that means that the current homeowners lose the value of their home. The potential homeowners, the ones that who want to buy the home, mm-hmm. have lost the home. The neighborhood, all the people that live near that home, also lose the value of their home. And the reason, I live in Michigan, and we have seen this time and again. You could speak to realtors, mortgage processors, banks,
right.
They would verify what I'm saying. And I understand that there's more than one bank that's involved with the short sale process many times, and I understand that it's difficult. But what ends up happening is that the banks are receiving bailout money. They aren't hiring enough people to process the short sales, and the standards are all low. You know, they're decreasing, mm-hmm. and our home values can...
Well, I'm not aware of any whistleblower program specifically for inattention to short sales, but I certainly agree with you that more needs to be done. And I would say I think the GSEs also, Fannie and Freddie, need to do more to facilitate short sales. At the FDIC, under our loss share arrangements, we always required first that a borrower, it'd be determined whether a borrower could be eligible for a loan modification. But if that the income was not there to support a loan modification, we strongly encouraged short sales and agreed if the recoveries were significant to share, you know, provide affirmative financial incentives to facilitate short sales. I think it's very important. It's important to the market clearing to get this done and get this done in a timely way and not to keep borrowers who realize that they won't be able to hold on to the house, the ability to sell. And so I think you're right on. We had also pushed, I had pushed, I don't know if it's going to be in this global settlement that the state AGs are working on with the servicers, but we had strongly suggested that there be a short sale incentive component in that settlement. And I hope when that announcement, if and when it's reached, includes some strong incentives to short sales.
Thanks for calling, Karen. Here's an email, and apparently there are several similar to this. This from Harry in Stoughton, Massachusetts. Is it not true that most of these toxic derivative assets are still on the books of the banks? Right. And even more outrageous, is it not true that these crazy derivatives are still a big part of the business that banks profit from?
Right. Well, I have the collateralized debt obligations that were made out of the lower tranches of these mortgage-backed securitizations. I think those balances have been wound down. A lot of that's been charged off already. So that particular toxic derivative structured instrument
at the very bottom.
Yes, but certainly the derivatives market generally is huge, and I do think it's important to differentiate between the foreign currency and interest rate derivative markets, and there's some problems there. I don't suggest there's not, but they were really not a big driver of the crisis. They're more developed markets and have functioned better, certainly than the credit default swap market, where we were seeing the problems. And that market still concerns me greatly, yeah. And I don't think we've done enough. I think it's a highly concentrated market. It skews incentives in a way that is not a positive, and so I think there's some real work to be done there. And Dodd-Frank does authorize a better oversight of the CDS market, trying to move as much as you can onto exchanges. It also includes directives to the Fed to start putting limits on concentrations, because the problem with these derivatives is that the bulk of the market is heavily concentrated just in a handful of very large institutions. So if you start seeing a problem, it's all that interconnectedness is what gets you into trouble. That's what we saw in 2008, certainly with AIG. So it's still a problem.
To Dallas, Texas. Hi there, Mark.
Hi, good morning, Diane.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First off, I want to make sure that I, along with a lot of listeners, fully understand the financial trail of tears, as it were, as I was trying to focus on the match that lights the fuse,
right.
As opposed to looking at who's holding the bomb when it goes off in their face. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were basically, for a lack of a better word, robo-signing mortgages to people who couldn't afford them and then selling those to the banks, correct?
Well, I think there were a couple of things going on. I think Fannie and Freddie's culpability in this, if you will, is that they really fueled the private label mortgage-backed securities. So it wasn't so much the mortgages that they were buying and securitizing on their own. It was the investments they were making in the private label, the Wall Street securitizations. Yes, and they were a huge part of that market. I think there was about a third of the market in 2005. They really fueled these toxic mortgage products through their purchases of these Wall Street securitizations.
But weren't they also being pressured by the Congress to get into that market?
There was, I think, I don't know if there was pressure. I think they were making a lot of money off of it. I don't think they needed to be pressured too much. I think home ownership, though, was the rationale, and HUD did give them credit toward their affordable housing goals by buying these securities, which I think, in retrospect, was not a good decision. So They did fuel it in that context, and I think that's unfortunate, and they were trying to make money. It was a nice arbitrage. They were operating like a hedge fund. They could issue debt at very low rates because of their implied government support, and then they could invest in these high-yielding mortgage-backed securities, and they were making a lot of money off of it.
All right, to Smithtown, New York. Good morning, Santo.
Hi, Diane. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Surely.
I'm just calling, I think, as a disheartened homeowner, and I think that I represent thousands of people out there. I just received my foreclosure notice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. After 2.5 years of applying for a modification, I was strung along by my bank. The lady talks about, Ms. Baer talks about the point of contact. Well, I had 4 points of contact. I had 4 different relationship managers, so-called. And after 3 or 4 months, when it was close to possibly having a decision, a different relationship manager. This went on for 2.5 years. I sent hundreds of documents talking about this procedure, operational procedure, great phrase, but it doesn't help the homeowner.
Right.
I think what's happened in a sense is that the whole system has turned around, and that now it's the banker beware rather than the consumer beware. In addition to that, Lay talks about standing on your own 2 feet. I never asked anybody to pick to stand up for me.
Right.
All I asked was for a hand up.
Right.
That's all I needed.
Right.
Just a little assistance, and this was it's very timely that this happened today.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, and I wish this was a unique situation. But it's when I was the chairman of the FDIC, I would get letters and emails from people all the time. And
to break your heart.
Yes, and I had a couple people on my staff that would track them down, and we could usually, on a one-on-one basis, the chairman of the FDIC shouldn't have to intervene to get somebody an answer. And I think this is just symptomatic of the larger problem: understaffing, poor training, high turnover, not enough attention to servicing. It's not a profit center, and it's not going to be, but the litigation exposure and the broader economic damage being caused by this understaffing of servicing is really, in the long term, very problematic, even for the banks.
If you could wave a wand, what are the 3 things you would do to solve this crisis now, this homeownership crisis?
I wish I could say there was a solution, but there's really not. I think simplifying the loan modification process. We suggested at one time a supermod proposal to anybody that was more delinquent on their loan, more than 60 days delinquent, offer to take them down to below appraised value, let them refinance, try to perform on the lower principal balance, or do a short sale. And do it a one-time offer, and in return for that, the borrower, if the borrower agreed, if there was a redefault, then they would have to agree to turn in the keys. So you didn't have to go in this forever foreclosure process.
Yeah.
So that was one idea. I think second liens continues to be a problem, an impediment to getting the first lien modified. Too many of these second liens are being held as performing assets when, in point of fact, the first lien is delinquent and underwater. Those second liens, even if they're making the minimum payment every month, those are not good assets anymore. And so getting those into a non-accrual situation so you no longer have economic disincentives to block a modification, I think, could – and I think there is some progress on that. So I think simplifying the government programs, having one government program, I think it would be
would
helpful.
Certainly help.
It
Do
would
you expect anything like that to come from President Obama?
I don't know. I hope so. I think, these are not really glamorous ideas. We're just simplifying it. Making it simpler is not a big press release or anything, but boy, it could do so much good. And let's face it, getting the banks to staff up more on servicing, we need to do that. But the servicing capacity is what it is. And the simpler the program, the more mods you're going to get. The more complicated you're going to make it with this understaffing, the more difficult it is.
And, of course, they're sitting on huge amounts of money.
Well, banks are profitable. They actually, the second quarter of this year was pretty good. And
but
so
they could hire more people to help with
this service. And I got to tell you, long term, it's in their financial interest to do so, because the litigation building on this is quite problematic.
To Pompano Beach, Florida. Hi there, Daniel.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
This question is for the former FDIC chair. I have a feeling that the our fiscal policy, with us being a lender of last resort, meaning the taxpayers, of the FDIC, creates a moral hazard which distorts risk, and thereby creating the situation that we're in. Shouldn't we be out of the business of bailing out anybody? Why don't they just go through the regular bankruptcy process?
Right. Well, I think for insured banks, we've had a system that's worked well ever since 1933. And I think I'm a traditionalist. I like markets to decide how resources are allocated. And as I said before, I like people to stand on their own 2 feet. But with insured deposits, I think we have a long history of success with the FDIC and the resolution process that we use. And I do think there is merit in having a safe place for people to keep their money, where they know they can immediately access it, where they know they're not going to suffer any losses. And by providing that safe haven, you do provide a good boost to credit intermediation so those deposits can be used to make loans. That's a traditional banking model, and that's the model that works well. But giving people the peace of mind of protection for their insured deposits, I think over the years, over the decades of success, can and is justified. And it's a Main Street benefit. It's not a benefit for large institutions. It's a Main Street benefit, and I think is justified. And I would also say the losses, the FDIC is funded by the industry. So government taxpayers, we do have the ability to borrow from Treasury. We never did during the crisis. Mm. The banks pay to cover our losses. So it is a closed system in that sense.
Sheila Bayer, former chair of the FDIC, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What's happening in Europe? How do you believe it could affect us?
Right. Well, I think it's a very difficult situation. I still think it's a manageable situation. I think the political, you know, as we saw with our debt limit crisis, our self-made debt limit crisis here, the political process did not work as well as it should have. And I think we're seeing the same problem in Europe. And, of course, it's complicated because you have so many different governments that have to achieve agreement on this. But and here again, my fear is that the problem will have to reach near crisis proportions before there's a catalyst for taking really decisive action. And so, you know, these kind of half measures and incremental steps, they're politically expedient but aren't solving the problem. And banks are going to have to take some losses. Stronger governments are probably going to have to help weaker governments. I know that's not politically popular, but I think that's what's going to have to happen.
And then how does it come to rest on our shoulders?
Well, I think the there's not much direct exposure between U.S. banks and the banks of the weaker countries in Europe. But there is, for the European banking system generally, obviously, there's a lot of interconnectedness. So I think a banking crisis in Europe could definitely harm the banking system here. Now, that said, there are, in Dodd-Frank, there is the ability, if you have what is called, you know, a system-wide event, so in other words, an event that is destabilizing to the system, not because banks mismanage themselves, but because of an external force, then there is the ability of the Fed and the FDIC to step in with liquidity support. I don't think it would come to that, but those legal tools are there. So I think under Dodd-Frank, the regulators would have the ability to deal with it if it gets to that stage. But I don't think it will get to that stage. I think it's starting to come to a head here, and I think the politicians in Europe, at least maybe I'm being overly optimistic, are finally coming to the grips with the fact there's no place to hide on this. They're just going to have to make some tough, politically unpopular decisions.
Is there any place that you feel Americans, people in this country, can now put their money and feel confident?
Well, I think insured deposits are obviously a proven place of safety, and so I think if you want something that you know absolutely know is going to be protected, keep your money in the bank below the insured deposit limits. I think treasuries actually are still a safe haven, even though the problems we've had with getting the debt limit raised and the downgrade. I think that still, I'm going to again be optimistic that we have a process in place that's going to get our fiscal situation
under control. Well, I'm glad you're optimistic. Is there anything you would have done differently as chair of the FDIC?
As chair of the FDIC. You know, hindsight's always 2020.
It's okay.
I think I would have, we had backup authority for insured banks. We didn't for bank holding companies, where a lot of the risk was. So using that earlier, kind of insisting, even though it would have upset the other regulators, to send our own examiners into some of these large institutions earlier. I would have done that. I think one small thing that I still kick myself on to this day was when IndyMac failed. We were consulted by the OTS, which was the primary regulator, which revoked the charter, closed the bank. But the decision was made to close the bank prior to normal closing hours. And so you ended up with a situation where people were coming in trying to do their business and the bank was closed. And that scared people. And I regret that very much. From then on, the policy was you close them after normal business hours are over with.
Sheila Barrett, former chair of the FDIC. Here's a last email from Lisa in Polkton, North Carolina. Uh-huh. I propose a Sheila Bear, Elizabeth Warren ticket for president.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you,
being
Diane.
Here.
It was fun.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.